and welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. My guest for today is Ben Jada, founder and CEO of RevTerra, a Houston startup that's created a kinetic battery technology that can enable rapid EV charging. A physicist by training, Ben explains how he took an idea he had in his postdoctorate work and turned it into the growing company it is today. He also shares what all he has on the horizon for RevTerra, including building out a new lab and launching new pilot programs. Ben, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to talk to you about RevTerra and everything you've accomplished, as well as what the future holds for the company. But let's back up a little bit and tell me a little bit about your background and how your career led to creating this company.
Yeah, sure. So before starting the company and after undergrad, my background was primarily in academic research. So I did my PhD in physics at the University of Houston. And then after that, I did two postdoctoral fellowships. So I did one at the Air Force Research Lab in New Mexico, and then I worked at Rice University for a while. So I found that the graduate school and academic research pathway actually lended itself pretty well to entrepreneurship. It certainly provided some of the skills, skill sets that were proved invaluable as starting the company took place later on. But yeah, my background primarily before starting the company was more of a research setting.
I think that's so interesting because I think everyone, founders usually have like one or the other, right? The research background, the technology background, or the entrepreneurship background. But you're saying you felt like you had good preparation in both just from your background?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So you might not typically associate a PhD program with entrepreneurship, but it does teach you a lot of relevant skills. So one of the things that you have to do during a PhD is pick a problem and figure out a solution to it. You also have to be able to pitch your solution to various people. One of those people is typically your PhD advisor, but you have a committee and you have, reviewers and peer-reviewed journals that when you publish, you have to have back and forth with. And if, you're particularly far along, you might have some grant proposals that you're submitting during your PhD. So all of these involve the process of finding a problem, finding a solution, presenting it clearly to an audience. And I think, I didn't really realize it at the time, but I think that is pretty good preparation for starting a company.
I think founders who are listening in who maybe didn't have the PhD background are like, wait, yes, that's exactly what we do. So tell me about when you realized this, idea for your company and what was, those early days, first steps that you had.
Yeah. Initially, the company started I started the company to work on commercializing a magnetic bearing technology that I developed. And the concept was basically to commercialize the bearing itself and then sell it into a variety of different applications. That it became clear that that was quite challenging because each embodiment of the technology in these different applications was so different that it would have been more of a services company or a consulting type company where each end product is customized completely to, the end customer. And that's not necessarily something I was interested in doing. So I, over time, refined the end product from the bearing itself to a specific application of the technology, which was an energy storage. And I had always been interested in clean energy and energy storage, and specifically clean energy storage. So energy storage that has a very low environmental footprint and, doesn't create a larger problem than the problem we're trying to solve. So kinetic energy storage really was the perfect application for the bearing technology. And then since then, it's, you know, the bearing technology was kind of the initial starting point. And now we have a lot of other aspects of the technology besides the bearing itself. But that was kind of how it got started. And, you know, once we started focusing on kinetic energy storage, we focused a little bit more into a specific beachhead market, which is high power electric vehicle charging. And I can get into at some point why we were interested in that.
Well, definitely. And let's get into that. And maybe just at a general level, explain what the technology does and how it's kind of different from what's out there already.
Sure. So one of the challenges with electric vehicle charging and electric vehicle adoption is we're going to need a lot of charging stations to quickly charge electric cars. And people are familiar with filling their gas tank in a few minutes. So an experience similar to that is what people are looking for when it comes to electric vehicles. And the power level required to charge a typical EV in, you know, let's say 10 minutes is quite high. It's about 350 kilowatts of power. So if you consider, you know, just a handful of these chargers running at the same time, it actually puts a tremendous strain on the electric grid. So you usually have to get the utility company involved. You have to dig trenches to bring in additional distribution lines. And it's generally a complex and expensive proposition. So this is a bottleneck when it comes to installing a large network of fast chargers. What you can do instead of that is basically put an intermediary. So you have, let's say you have a low power connection and you want a high power fast charger. You can put a buffer. So it's an energy storage system and it just buffers between a low power connection and the high power charger. So it slowly accumulates energy over a long period of time. And when a car or truck or a commercial vehicle comes in to charge at high power, that energy storage system discharges at high power. So it's an energy accumulator and high power energy discharger. The conventionally available technology for this would be electrochemical batteries. Electrochemical batteries are really well suited for longer duration applications or lower power applications or lower cycle count applications. So if you have an electric car, for example, you're charging it, you know, once every couple of days, maybe once every day. So you're, you know, cycling it a maximum of a few hundred times a year. But when it comes to the charger, if you have a battery at the charging station, you have to charge it multiple times per day because that battery is now charging a bunch of cars coming in every day to the charging station. So you have a scenario where you're asking the energy storage system to output a substantial amount of power. And you're asking it to do that many times per day. So that's kind of where kinetic energy storage really shines. It is capable of a very high power to energy ratio because those two things are decoupled in kinetic energy storage, meaning you can arbitrarily basically increase the power with a given energy storage content. But the cycle life is also extremely high. And typically, you know, kinetic energy storage systems have a somewhat niche application because of maintenance issues, high cost per kilowatt hour. So our approach has been to leverage the existing technology in kinetic energy storage, which is basically an off-the-shelf piece of low-cost steel spinning at high speed, and improve that with our magnetic bearing technology and some other improvements to the overall architecture of the system as it applies to EV charging.
Well, that sounds like a very complex and convoluted thing. So I'm almost like afraid to ask this question, but what has been like the biggest obstacle to developing the technology, the biggest challenge you've faced since, you know, having this idea and trying to execute on it?
I would say there've been a few. One was early stage funding. So and a lot of, I think a lot of early stage technology companies have this issue or come across this issue, which is there is a gap between lab scale technology and commercial scale technology. And that gap is usually filled by some type of demonstration unit, but that demonstration unit is not necessarily large enough to be purchased by a commercial customer, or it's not tested enough for a commercial customer that wants to buy something that's actually, you know, been tested in the field. And so those types of projects are not the types of projects that are funded in universities, and they may be too early for venture capital firms as well. So that's where some government funding programs like SBIR grants come into play, as well as angel investors. So getting across that bridge, I would say, was a challenge. Getting that early or initial demonstration unit tested and demonstrated. And then I think another challenge is getting early customers and early customer traction. And that kind of comes back to the same point of finding prospective customers that are willing to take some technology risk or some level of technology risk and are early adopters, so to speak, in that they want to be at the forefront of this new technology for whatever their end application is. So that was another challenge, finding customers that were early adopters and willing to take a little bit of technology risk, you know, at the stage of where we're at right now. I would say those were the two primary challenges, and certainly there were others as well.
Well, you did it, and you raised the Series A last year. So I want to ask you about that. How have you been able to deploy the capital from your $6 million Series A round that you closed last year?
Right. So the Series A round goes primarily towards, in our case, towards hiring the team. So we've built up the team substantially. We've hired three engineers, two mechanical engineers, one electrical engineer, and we're planning to hire a couple of additional engineers over the next few months. It is also going towards capital expenditures in the sense of improving and building up our laboratory. So we have in-house capabilities to assemble and test these units here in Houston. And building up that facility is where some of the Series A funds are going to. And another category is supporting our deployments of our pilot tests. So we do have pilot tests planned for later this year. And some of the funding from the Series A will go towards actually helping us to deploy those and get them tested in the hands of a customer. There are also other aspects such as getting certification, getting these things tested in the field. But those are the first three.
So I know a lot of times completing a round and either growing your relationships with your investors or, you know, having new investors helps with that finding customer part and other things like mentorship and guidance and that. How would you describe your relationship with your investors and how they, the role they play in growing the company?
Yeah. So in my experience, it is really important to develop the relationship with your investors. So in my case, both from the angel investment round, but also in the Series A, I developed a what I would say is a really good working relationship with the investors. And that comes through multiple meetings months in advance of when they actually invest, because investors want to gain basically multiple data points, seeing your development, the company's development. But getting a good relationship with the investors that come in proves very invaluable later on down the road as you seek advice on various company milestones and as they provide really helpful feedback to you, whether it's in customer development or even future fundraising efforts.
So you mentioned, you know, growing your team more, hiring more. when you look at 2023, what are some of your biggest focus points? Are you going to introduce another round, for instance? You know, what's on the horizon for y'all?
Yeah, so this year is really focused on product development and deploying our pilot tests. So, you know, product development partially involves building up the team a bit, but really it's a focus on engineering for the first half of the year. And the second half of the year will be primarily focused on deploying them in the context of a real world application. So that is definitely the primary focus, but we're always in parallel to that, continuing to develop relationships with prospective customers that we've been talking to for additional pilots next year.
And then when you zoom out a little bit and look at the next several years or even decade for RevTerra, what would you say is the benchmark for success for y'all? What sort of things you have on that big picture vision board for RevTerra?
We really want to be an enabling technology in the renewable energy transition. So one part of that is facilitating the development of large scale, high power, fast charging networks. But beyond that, we see this technology as a potential solution in other areas related to the clean energy transition. So one of those is something called grid inertia. Grid inertia is something that not a whole lot of people are familiar with, but is critically important to the way our conventional AC electric grid works. And essentially, this is provided for free by conventional synchronous generators that run on fossil fuels that power the grid today. If one of them goes offline, the other ones actually provide physical inertia. So they have rotating energy just like flywheels do. And that rotational energy prevents the grid frequency from plummeting if a generator goes offline. So it stabilizes the grid. If you go to a fully renewables powered grid, or even just really high renewables penetration, you lose that inertia, although it can be provided synthetically through batteries and a virtual control system. But flywheels can actually provide it in exactly the same way that it is provided today by synchronous generators. So it is a very conservative way of maintaining reliability and stability on a fully renewables powered grid. So we see that as a application of the technology down the road, and maybe even something that we could provide as a service from EV charging stations. And so, yeah, the vision is initially focused on high power EV charging, but deploying the technology in other real applications to support the energy transition.
Yeah, I think something that a big challenge, a big obstacle in the greater energy transition has always been energy storage, just waiting for the right technology to come around to really like allow for better energy storage in the renewable space. So I guess I'm just wondering, since I have you here, what have you observed over the past few years to enable better opportunities, better technologies for energy storage? Obviously, RevTerra being a big part of that, but is it a better place now moving forward, or do we still need new technologies in the energy transition to enable this storage?
Right. And so are you asking more focused on Houston specifically, or is it kind of generally?
Yeah, I was talking more generally just because, yeah, you hear it a lot, any sort of conference or meeting that's talking about the energy transition, like storage technology is a big part of it, as well as several other, you know, entities. But I know that's a huge challenge to kind of get through so that we can actually have some of the transition of the energy transition.
Right. Yeah. So the question is basically, what other technologies do we need to get?
Well, how you've seen it evolve. Has it evolved? Okay. You know, has it changed a lot since day one?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I think my viewpoint is kind of, you know, probably focused specifically on the Houston ecosystem. But I would say, generally speaking, even, you know, several years ago, the NSF and other grant funding agencies have been really crucial in funding these early stage technologies and providing the SBIR or STTR grants to bridge the gap between lab scale and commercial scale. So that valley of death, I think that's definitely still the case today. I think there is more funding now. I think there are more funding opportunities, and even especially for slightly further along clean energy technologies, it seems that there are more funding opportunities now than there were back then. I also think that there are more opportunities when it comes to early stage funding outside of those grants. But I think those are still kind of the primary method for a really early stage technology or early stage company to prove its technology and get additional funding down the road.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, we can talk about the Houston lens too. Of course, that's something I want to talk to you about. But yeah, how has it been founding your company in Houston? How have you been able to tap into this evolving and emerging Houston innovation ecosystem to really benefit your company growth?
Yeah, I would say that the Houston innovation ecosystem has evolved and improved tremendously over the past few years. When I started the company, there were a couple of accelerators or incubators around that were certainly helpful, but now there's quite a few more. You have Greentown Labs, which we're a part of, and you have places like Halliburton Labs, which provide also, you know, physical space and lab space. But in addition to that, large-scale machinery, I believe, to help you build and prototype your early-stage technology. And you have the ION across the street from us as well. So none of those three were around a few years ago. I think there's certainly still room for improvement as well. You have, you know, places like Boston and San Francisco, where you probably have more, even more opportunities when it comes to programs that come with capital. So for early stage companies that are getting into an accelerator program, having some capital or investment associated with that, I think goes a long way to helping them get that initial proof of concept developed. But yeah, I would say tremendous development in the Houston ecosystem, both from the availability of resources, accelerators, incubators, but also in the number and quality of startup companies that are here doing similar work. I think it's just, it seems like an exponential increase since just a few years ago.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think, yeah, everything you've observed seems, you know, right on par with what I've seen over the years as well. I guess just to wrap up, like, tell me a little bit about maybe something you wish you'd known when you started your company, or something you really want your fellow energy transition startup founders to know about, you know, starting their company now and here in Houston.
That's a tough one, because there's quite a few things. I would say one thing is just to know that starting a company is a long-term process. You're building something over a period of years, usually. And it is something that you have to really commit your full-time effort to. So when I first started the company, before I started working on it full-time, I was doing some part-time work on it while I was doing my postdoctoral fellowship at Rice. And they, you know, most of the investors that I talked to at the time were interested, but it is a little bit harder to get people to commit when you're still working on it part-time. So I would say as soon as you can, commit to working full-time on your venture, if possible, really accelerates the development process. Although certainly, you know, sometimes you have to start before you're full-time on it. And the other thing that I wish I had known when I started the company was just a little bit more about the fundraising process, how that works, and the importance of really focusing on the value proposition, and the, you know, business development side of things, in addition to just the core technology itself. And I think that is sometimes maybe something that's missed early on in the development process, but is, you know, critically important when you're, you know, even ignoring the funding aspect of it, just framing the direction of the company and the product that you're developing kind of goes hand in hand with talking to customers and understanding the market.
Yeah, and that's probably something too that's going to vary by technology, you know, finding the right venture capital firms to talk to and ones that will maybe easier to understand your technology if they're in the right field, right? Like it's kind of a bit of a matchmaking thing where you have to find the right investors, which is a whole other challenge, right?
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I really appreciate your time today and talking me through all of this. And it's really exciting to see Revterra and how much it's accomplished already and where it's going. So thank you for your time today. It's such a unique company and I'm so glad it's here in Houston.
You're welcome. Thank you for the invitation. It was great chatting with you.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.